Joined here with Scott Jackich. He blogs at Oakland Futurist. Scott, it's great having you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here.
And I'm also joined here with Rabbit.
Great to be on again.
So, Scott, you write a lot about futurism. Can you talk about how you got interested in the topic?
Oh, yeah, sure. So, I was definitely interested in futurism from a very young age. I was reading science fiction like Asimov and Heinlein and how the golden age science fiction writers. And that was kind of an escapism for me, I think, when I was young, to go to the stars, you know, and or the, you know, the caves of steel and whatnot. I've always been interested from a science fiction point of view, and what I found in the Bay Area is that it's more of like an interest among a lot of people here. And so I started organizing a meetup here in the Bay Area around 2009 to talk about futurist topics and whatnot.
Yeah, I was reading about them. I thought they were interesting because, you know, normally when people do something like that, it's just like, oh, let's have a meetup, you know, once a week or something. But you have like a four-part series on what these meetups are going to be all about, what they're going to entail or anything. I thought that was pretty interesting that you put a lot of thought into it. Do you want to go into that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. So that's more of so I've been doing the meetup for a couple of years now, right? What I'm trying to do is, so the basis of this goes back to, there's this idea of, I think there's a David Chapman. Are you guys familiar with him? He writes that on meaningness, and he's been talking about Keegan a lot, which is these developmental stages. There's a whole background to it, but basically the idea is that in the modern era we're very isolated, right? And we need it's just the nature of the way our society is constructed, right? We move away from home where we grew up for job or for school and whatnot. And we tend to be compartmentalized. You know, we're not part of some tribe, we're not part of some village anymore. And so there are these attempts, and I think a futurist group in and of itself is really an attempt of people to kind of find their own tribe. And the series that I'm writing, that I've written recently, is trying to get into, like, maybe even making that even more permanent, like this idea of actually having a club with a physical space to kind of ground that social activity. And I think it is. I just think it's a need that a lot of us have, to feel like we belong to a group and, the people who are going to care about us and connect to us.
I've thought a lot about that topic as well. In the past, people were more in these kind of like traditional tribal societies and not even, I mean, a long time ago, people were in tribes, but even as recently, say like the 1950s, you see these different like religious groups like Mormons, and there's pros and cons to that. On one hand, you're given this sense of community, but you're also kind of born into a group, and you kind of have to follow the rules of that group. And you may happen to be born into a group where you may dislike that particular culture or values of that, or you maybe just get along, you maybe not get along with people. And then today we went through the stage where people have become more kind of atomized and disconnected. So with the way we're headed, is there's a lot of opportunities for people to kind of form their own groups, but based on kind of like-minded ideas and giving people more of a sense of freedom.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point that you brought up. I mean, this idea of a futurist group is a totally non-coercive sort of tribe, you might say, right? And no one's going to force you to be a futurist. You don't have to meet these expectations, like you might have to as a Mormon or as a, you know, born into a village, but I do think, yeah, I am optimistic about it. I think that people naturally reach out and try to do these things. All subculture is really an attempt to do this, where we have, you know, people getting together in different musical subcultures, or even Comic-Con and the people who like to do that kind of role-playing and cosplay and whatnot. These are all subcultures where people are trying to, you know, build these totally intentional tribes they get to choose. I think that these are things that are going to continue, and they're going to develop, and they're meeting people's basic kind of social needs.
Do you see a political divide within the futurist movement? Like, say, there's like liberals, there's libertarians, then you have like the dark enlightenment and alt right.
Yeah, we're talking a little bit about that. Yeah, I mean, I think that for sure, all of those groups are represented in the Bay Area. In my group, we talk about all of those topics quite freely. But I think there are some arguments, you know, sure, between libertarians and, you know, the Bay Area is very liberal, right? I mean, I even think that you wouldn't even recognize Bay Area libertarians, right? Because we're so, you know, the libertarians here are so steeped in this like very, very left-wing culture. And really, the Dark Enlightenment is really just sort of the flip side, in my view, of just sort of a knee-jerk reaction, sort of like Satanism, right? I mean, you can't have Dark Enlightenment without like extreme social justice. It's a reaction to social justice. I myself have no trouble talking to any of those people and trying to appreciate where they're coming from. I mean, you know, I disagree with. I'm very much a centrist now, you know, myself. But, I disagree, obviously, I think very strongly with Dark Enlightenment. One of the fundamental disagreements I have is that, you know, I'm a Whig. I believe in progress. And I subscribe to Pinker's Better Angels thesis, in which we just see, like, really kind of relentless progress, over very long stretches of time. You know, many fewer people dying from war and whatnot. And in my view, the Dark Enlightenment really kind of has an opposite view, that we're descending from some prior peak, a human pinnacle that happened sometime in the past. And that just seems like fundamentally and empirically incorrect. But, you know, at the same time, I understand kind of why, people are drawn to this at the same time. I have friends who feel like social justice is really oppressive. And political correctness is really doing, I think, material harm to academia in particular in America. This is something that my mind has been changed on. You know, like my friend Mike Johnson and other people who come to my meetup really are adamant about this, and I've been skeptical about it. But the incidents with Christakis and others, I think, kind of illustrate that. There's a point to be made there that social justice is a very damaging aspect, and that's the way in which I'm sympathetic, I think, on that side. I think overall in the future, I don't see us really fighting too much. You know, we fight on Facebook or something, but it's not a really political movement. We're not like I said, we were talking about before. We're not like the fascists of Italy. Those futurists. Who are going to go design Mussolini's headquarters or something, you know, that futurism is really political. But I mean, I don't think ours is.
Rabbit, you were telling me that you originally got interested in like a dark enlightenment because you kind of liked the idea of people being able to form their own societies, but you kind of got repelled by a lot of their extreme, like, reactionary views. Rabbit, can you comment on that briefly?
Yeah, I mean, what attracted me initially to neo-reaction and that stuff was some of the was the futurism and the kind of some of the HBD stuff. I just found that it was interesting that, like, once I got into that scene, that it was popular. Like, it was populated mostly by like these radical traditionalist types that actually like wanted to go back to living out on the prairie, like Little House on the Prairie kind of lifestyle or something. Like that's not me. My idea of futurism is building condominiums on the moon and stuff. Not just this kind of weird kind of backwoods things that just incorporates a little bit of futurist farming or something. I don't know. That's the best way that I can describe it though.
Going to Utah. What was it? Nisimov's plan. I forget what Nisimov's plan. I don't want to say anything bad about Mike. I like Mike.
I like him too. I've read his Idaho book and
Idaho.
I thought it was very good. Yeah, the Idaho Project, and I think he does have a lot of great ideas. A lot of people don't get along with him, but I try to stay out of the personal stuff.
Yeah. No, I think he's very likable. I mean, I think he's I think he does. He's bombastic and whatnot. We'll see. Hopefully, he'll come. Hopefully, he has that together and come back and start participating in intellectual debate again. I think he's kind of taking a break from that.
You said previously you've been on the left. It's kind of funny you brought that up because when Anatoly Karlin recommended that I interview you, he described you as an open-minded liberal, kind of in quotes, because there's kind of, as you said, there's the stereotypes of the social justice warriors. Can you talk about how your views have changed from being more liberal to being more of a centrist and a pragmatist?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things, I like to frame that a little bit. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Jonathan Haidt's moral frameworks. And Haidt has this way of measuring liberals and conservatives by breaking out sort of what do they value. And what he notices, and this is, he has empirical evidence for this, some studies that show that liberals tend to, value freedom from harm, and equality and sort of justice more than they value things like purity or respect for authority or in-group loyalty. And so along those lines, I'm very much a natural liberal. Now, of course, I grew up, in Western New York, which is a very liberal place, actually. And when I was a kid, I had a close friend who was a lesbian communist, black lesbian communist, who explained white privilege to me, and I was quite comfortable with that. I had no problem, with that. The funny thing is, and I think where I first started was challenged, intellectually on these issues was when I met Razib Khan at a Singularity Summit. And Razib Wright was at that time writing Gene Expression for Discovery. People know him as a popular blogger. I don't know where he's probably blogging at Oons now and other places. But, when Razib made some comment, I forget. I was talking about Wright, I felt uncomfortable with some of the conversations. But I said, I feel like white privilege, whatever. I feel, I have this white privilege and so whatever. And then Razib was really offended. And he said, well, how dare you kind of assert that you're higher status than I am? And I was completely taken aback. I had no idea what he was talking about. And I had to think about that for a minute. I'm like, when you're asserting privilege, you're sort of asserting status. Right? and if you think about it in that way, and when that framing, Razib's framing for that, really kind of fundamentally changed the way I thought about privilege. And it almost made social justice seem a little bit insidious, in the sense that it's sort of robbing. Because I think tied to privilege and the sense of privilege is also tied to a sense of agency. It's sort of like there's a social justice narrative in which only white men are the ones who take action, and everyone else has things done to them. Right? It's sort of like white men are the hammers, and everyone else is a nail. And if you buy into that, if you were really to buy into that narrative, and this is where I don't understand, and this is where a lot of dark enlightenment or MRAs or whatever, I have a deep disagreement with. So in some sense, it's saying this is privilege could be thought of as a sort of agency, or assigned agency. Tries to adopt the idea that, we're not privileged. It's in some sense denying our agency. And on the social justice side, I think it's denying people who are, underrepresented or minorities or women. In some sense, it's a narrative that steals agency from people. And it's harmful, I think, in that, And that's another strange way in which it's harmful. And so this is, like, but this is not what I thought as a kid. None of this stuff ever occurred to me as a kid.
What are your thoughts on on HBD? I know Reziva writes a lot about that.
I think that, it's easy to take the wrong, to draw the wrong conclusions, from some of these topics. Crick came out and, was it Watson or Crick? Who was it? They got castigated for his comments on African IQ and whatnot. I think that, when we talk about things like IQ, I have a close friend who Robin Baru, who made the comment to me, well, we might actually even reconsider IQ as being a test for conformity. How much will you obey the rules? And Chomsky agrees with this too. He talks about education as being sort of an obedience filter. And the correlations of success in culture, which fits still in that case. If we just recast IQ as simply being obedient, you could easily make the case that the reason people are successful in culture is because they're more obedient, and they're more cooperative. I think when we think about things in that way, a lot of these discussions around HBT become more nuanced, right? I am very much sympathetic to the idea that there's a lot of cognition is actually solving problems. That's how I define cognition. Cognition is solving problems. And I don't think that IQ captures all of the problems that can be solved. I hear a lot of arguments, that people will make, along those lines, there's a guy on Facebook, I forget his name, and he gets all these statistics about how blacks are only shot, in America, blacks are only shot in proportion to the crimes they commit, and all this Black Lives Matter stuff is blowing out of proportion, they don't understand statistics, and blah, blah, blah. And on the one hand, I can go and look at the statistics and say, okay, these look compelling. But on the other hand, it's there's rule of law. And the reason we have rule of law is so, you don't shoot people on the street. And so it's at some point you gotta say, wait a minute, regardless of statistics, it simply doesn't matter. The police shouldn't be shooting people on the streets. That's not what rule of law entails. That's not how a civilization should function. There are ways in which, I accept some of the premises of the people that talk about HBD, but I disagree with the conclusion very often. Because I think there are other things to consider that a lot of times are left out of those conversations.
Are you familiar with this movement, started by this blogger Robert Lindsay called the Alt Left? And, he accepts, HBD, but he mixes it in with, liberal politics.
Actually, no, I haven't heard of that. But that sounds like to me, I should check out, actually. Should send me a link on that. I think IQ is definitely measuring something. But, I think it's funny, though, to think about, how many things IQ still seems to measure if you just say it's measuring, or how strong the correlations remain if you were just to say something obedience or something.
Yeah, no, I was wondering what you think about, transhumanism. And it seems like a lot of transhumanists kind of, they avoid a lot of the HBD stuff, and it's kind of like a race. Like they can kind of, if they can get this type of technology going, it will almost, it's a race against the ethnic conflicts that are going on, So it's like if they can get technology where everyone lives forever and all of this stuff that will kind of, if they can do it fast enough, the ethnic conflicts or whatever won't matter, so they kind of ignore those issues.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I think it's clear that the technology, the extreme augmentation, would be Lars. Ray disagrees. Kurzweil will say something along the lines of all technology has a product life cycle in which things are cheap at first. Things are expensive and terrible at first, and then they end up ubiquitous and cheap. Like, if you use this mobile technology as an example of that. That might be true, and I hope that's true. But I do think there are also ways in which there's a lot of outcomes are better for the rich, even with the technology, you know. And there are differences in how technology is used, and implemented by the rich as opposed to the poor. But I don't actually think that this is where I kind of differ with kind of like a very, optimistic view that Ray would have. And I think it's very possible for us to have like really big inequalities. I mean, look at it even today. I mean, yeah, so in Africa, everyone has a mobile phone, but people don't have running water. So it's like, the technology, like, where's the technology for that? Like, you just need a plumber, or it's more like a political issue. Like, you just need your states to get together and put in infrastructure.
I talked about that with Zoltan when he was on the show, and that's probably what would happen with the transhumanism. If it was implemented, it would more likely be accessible to the ultra-rich, so it could sort of exacerbate, like, extreme inequality.
Yeah. I mean, again, we were talking about this a little bit before. Like, I actually take a little bit of an issue with transhumanism. It's like the term itself. Like, if you don't know anything about transhumanism, then I'm a transhumanist. But if you identify as a transhumanist, then I'm going to refer you to what Ramez Nam says, who's a science fiction writer who wrote Nexus series, other things. And Ramez points out that, you know, there's no such thing as a transhumanist. All humans, want to augment. To even suggest that there's a type of human that doesn't want to augment is kind of a fallacy. You know, like, when we picked up a stick, you know, we were augmenting. And it's really just a very smooth continuum, beyond that. Like, if, you know, you talk about pacemakers or, you know, birth control modifying your chemistry, all humans are very eager to augment. And, you know, even the Amish don't forsake tools. They're frozen in time, they still are augmenting quite consistently. So I don't actually think there's, like, I don't view transhumanism as being, like, some kind of, like, discrete state or some state that we're going to reach. You know, I think it's something, it's a continuous function that we've always done, and it's going to just start to look stranger and stranger. But, yeah, at the same time, like, yeah, just like all technology, there are gaps, you know, there are inequalities.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I think that... one thing that always bothers me is when people say things like, that's not natural, you know, because in my mind, like, the human brain is like, it's biological, you know, so anything that it can technically get us to do is something that's of a biological origin, you know, because the brain is a biological organ, you know, unless you're going to argue that, that it comes from somewhere else, or something like that. So I tend to agree with that, and I think you're right. I mean, technically, you know, anyone who's gotten braces or, like, you know, had hair transplants or something is,
sure,
as a transhumanist.
Yeah.
So I don't know, this idea that when we do things like, oh, you know, we shouldn't do this, it's not natural or something like that. It's, you know, it's something that our brains can do, just like when a beaver builds a dam or something like that. It's like, it's no different. It's just that we have the capability to do a lot more.
Can you talk about your series you wrote, The Robot Ward Scenario, about artificial intelligence?
Oh, yeah. So I'm writing, yeah, that's actually, I want it to be a novel. I'm working on it. I want to be a science fiction writer. That's what I want to get to. I have to, I work as an IT consultant now. That's where I'm trying to transition in my life right now. But the premise came from actually an article called The Robot Lord Scenario. I forget the writer, I gotta look it up. But that, like, I probably have to rename the book itself, because I don't want to steal this guy's title. And it's a really good, story, it's a really interesting scenario that he came up with. What's this guy's name? I forget now. I gotta look it up. But so the author of that story was talking about, or the author, it's like an article talking about drones. And what he's pointing out is that, in the, like, historically, things like propaganda were necessary to mobilize large groups of people because humans were really necessary, to form a fighting force. And kind of guns were like this egalitarian technology in a sense. Like if you go back to the Middle Ages, you know, there were these knights, and these knights had this, you know, with armor and sword and spears, they could just wipe out any number of peasants. And the gun was like a great, equalizing force. With very little training, you could have, someone would be able to, you know, the average peasant in that case would have devastating military, capabilities. So in a sense, the era of the gun was this era in which we had this, you know, we needed propaganda, and the people in power had to actually convince a lot of people to fight in order for wars to be prosecuted. Now, in the age of automated weaponry, it changes the power dynamic. And so the argument of the robot lord scenario is that very few people, and Daniel Suarez wrote a novel called Kill Decision, which is along these same lines, in which like, you automated weapon systems can leverage like a huge amount of military advantage with very little buy-in from the broader public. Okay? And we actually see this, we see aspects of this today, right? Like we've been able to fight multiple wars overseas, like the Iraq War and others, without any conscription. Like nothing like the Vietnam era, right? And part of that could well be, as a result of increased automation and increase of the weapon systems, where you could have like smaller armies could do a lot more devastation. But this could go much further. This could go to the point where you don't need an army whatsoever. And you could have fully autonomous weapons platforms, prosecuting wars, like carrying out war. And almost no one would need to sign up for that. Now, I think what this author, this article, had even posited, like, a breakdown in society and, like, a return to feudal time. And you can imagine, like, you know, like a plutocratic billionaire simply just invests in enough, you know, billions of dollars and they build, like, an entire robot army. And they can control and all of the land that they own legally. And you can't, access farmland, you can't access mines, you can't access anything. Like, it doesn't matter what the rabble does. You could go and try to have a revolution, and good luck, because the automated tank platforms will blow you up. And it's all controlled by just a few guys in a control room. Right? And you could almost see how, like huge amounts of actual physical land could be, you know, controlled and protected that way. And a very small number of people would be able to control that. Totally crazy scenario, right? But very like plausible, like with, and this is kind of what autonomy gives you. Now the thing that I noticed, you know, when I thought about this is that, hackers are really kind of like the, I work peripherally in computer security. I've gone to DEF CON multiple times. I'm a systems administrator, so I have to watch out for the kind of people attacking me. I'm not a hacker. But I know that, like, our computer security is really terrible. Like, it's very, very hard to defend against attacks. Like, there's a huge advantage for attackers in the computer security realm. And there are many, many holes. And what I could see then, if we got to this kind of strange robot lord scenario, hackers would be, like, these amazing wild cards, right? They would be, like, these Loki figures of chaos because, if you're relying on, like, these automated platforms, as the essence of your power, this really relies on your information security. And hackers really have shown that, you know, there's not much information. If they walk in and out of the NSA, and, you know, the Chinese walk right through Lockheed Martin and RSA and compromise really deep American defense systems. Years ago, they've done that. And so, it's interesting. So that's kind of like, you know, and the funny thing is like, the book is kind of, like, the book that I started writing kind of diverged from that. I want to get back to that and kind of see how that scenario plays out. But that's kind of the gist of it.
And with automation of the economy, in the future, we're going to see a lot of jobs being replaced by robots. And there's a lot of different scenarios I mean, one, there's sort of the utopian scenario where robots do all the work and we can just kind of relax and pursue our whatever pursuits we want to. And then there's another kind of a more dystopian scenario where people become obsolete and kind of delegated either to like slavery or poverty. And those are both potential trends. What are your thoughts on that, and which scenario do you see as more likely?
I mean, I'm highly skeptical about we all get to sit back and work or not have to work, because, you know, I mean, look at America today, right? I mean, and I think I wrote an article called, America would rather go Mad Max than go socialist. And I think that's really true about America. You know what I mean? Like, I actually think that, like, it's, you know, how you get from, especially when you talk about, like, more automation of weapons, you know what I mean? It's like, revolution is going to become harder and harder. It's already, like, good luck having a revolution against the U.S. Army today. You know, like, just even an outdated weapons platform, like an F-16, it's going to, like, you know, it's going to lay Occupy and teabaggers, you know, completely to waste. Right, there's effectively no chance of having a revolution. And then if you had an automated platform, forget it. And so, like, if you wanted to, like, force the rich to give you, who own all the robots, who are automated all the jobs, to give you, like, a guaranteed minimum income, like, that probably can't happen. You know what I mean? And I think I mentioned before, like, I fall back to real politics. Like, you know, power, like, politics is just power. And if automation takes power away from the people, then really we're stuck relying on what the hackers are going to do for us. Maybe the hackers will be generous and will liberate resources for the people. But the other side of this is, like, you know, like, I was talking to Robin Hanson. And, you know, Robin Hanson's quite a conservative futurist, I think. But, you know, I think we do need to remember, though, that the Luddite fallacy has remained a fallacy. The idea that it isn't clear that automation has resulted in more unemployment. Certainly, world unemployment has dramatically, like, decreased. And it could well be that the Luddite fallacy remains a fallacy. Like, for every area that becomes automated, a new area will emerge in which humans have an advantage. And it might become, you know, like, we'll. And maybe it's not intuitive, but the things that humans will have an advantage in might be, like, really unintuitive. Just being composed of biological material and being soft and friendly, things like that. Maybe people will pay you to be a friend to them or something. I don't know.
What are your thoughts on the whole sort of, you've written about this, but you wrote an article a while back about this sort of notion that capitalism is a necessary for innovation and technology and innovation in general?
I mean, I argue with my, I have, so, yeah, so, there are people who, I'm friends with a lot of people on the left as well, right? And there are people who are my friends who will argue that capitalism does not equal markets. And so, to the degree that capitalism doesn't actually equal markets, then, okay, I think markets are required. That's right, because I was talking about Adam Ford, right? Well, one of the things it's Martin Ford. So one of the things Martin Ford talked about in Light in the Tunnel is that, well, without consumers, you kind of don't have markets, right? And consumers sort of act as, like, there are a lot of independent agents. If you think about it from, like, an information theoretical point of view, what are consumers? Consumers are, like, a lot of independent agents exploring problem space with a broad range of preferences, right? And so by doing this, like, they'll tell you, as opposed to, and this is, like, the opposite of, like, a planned economy or something, where, like, some people in a committee room decide what people must want and how to satisfy those needs. There's obviously, like, you're going to explore, like, much narrower aspects of solution space if there's just a committee, like a 5-year planning committee, than like, you know, millions or billions of consumers, like, with a lot of varying preferences. So this is, kind of like a structural reason why I think that markets are necessary for innovation. Because we can't predict, like no one person could predict. Now there are cases where, like, there are strange things like for instance, like we take Steve Jobs, or Henry Ford too, like they both would say something like, well, you know, if I asked the consumers what they wanted, they would have just told me like a faster horse. Henry Ford would say that. Nobody would have told Steve Jobs that they wanted an iPhone. But at the same time, if he hadn't been able to sell like millions and millions, billions of these devices, we wouldn't have realized what a good idea it was, right?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm more for a planned type of economy, but I think that markets will seem to always emerge no matter, you know, where I, you know, cause even you just end up with like a black market. You have those situations, like, you know, I'm sure that, people in Cuba, in North Korea, and for sure the Soviet Union, they still built up these markets still, they still came about. You know, they were just officially, sanctioned. It seems like even if you had a society with no money or anything, that you would have a group of people and you would find them start, you know, trading and whatnot, and the markets would form. So I think it would be pretty difficult to, you know, to get rid of market forces completely.
But you're somehow in favor of a planned economy still?
Well, I like the idea of, you know, not really complete individualism, but also, a certain kind of a society being planned and built, you know, that since the, you know, the community or the city or whatever, it affects everyone, you know, the buildings that are being built, you know, everyone has to see them. You know, I think that you can have a group of people who, get together and form, a type of society, and then other people, you know, who want to live in that kind of society can live there. I think that when you have a lot of these situations where it's just fully dominated by these market forces, that, you know, you end up with like Costco and Walmart and just a lot of garbage and like really bad architecture, you know. So I think that there is a role to play for economy planning and someone who has a certain group of people who have an actual vision for the society that people are going to live in. That's just what I would prefer. I wouldn't necessarily want to force that on billions of people.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Well, I mean, I guess one of the points I would make is that really, you know, this kind of ideal libertarian capitalism, like ideal free markets, are probably not, like, it's probably purely a theoretical construct, right? I don't, like, America is really kind of very socialist. We have zoning, right? Speaking to the point about, you know, what kind of buildings can be built. This is how it plays out in the real world. The way it plays out in America is we have zoning and we have, you know, people get together and vote on how, on what is allowed. Like, in some towns decide they don't want the Walmart, you know, and they enact zoning to prevent that. But yeah, I'm sympathetic to what you're saying.
Right, because if you look at the examples like where, you know, what cities look like where they have no zone, you know, where a lot of these places flock to, and these people like, you know, Robert and I have talked about this before, like, you know, like it's like the difference between like a city that looks like Dallas, Texas, you know, with like just endless like of these like garbage strip malls, and just really just like, really just anything goes that will make a buck, like it doesn't even matter. Whereas, you know, someplace like Seattle or something is, in my mind, is a much better city, which has much more restrictions on that. So I don't think it's necessarily you have to go all or nothing, but you can see the differences in aesthetics just based on these different types of societies, which, you know, some people don't care what's, they'd rather just go someplace where they can get the cheapest possible hamburger, and they don't care, you know. So they move to like they move to Arlington, Texas, or Dallas, or something like that. But,
yeah.
You know, other people who want to like have a monorail that has a view of the city or something, you know, they move somewhere else. You know?
Yeah. No. We see it in the Bay Area too. Like Emeryville is famous here for lack of zoning or being very friendly in terms of zoning. And yeah, it's just full of condos and it's full of big box stores and whatnot. But I think that's good. I mean, I actually think we need that kind of, like, pluralism, right? Like, we should have the areas. I mean, this is where I'm sympathetic to more of a libertarian view where people can experiment with different mechanisms of governance. And we'll see which one outcompetes the other.
So that kind of brings up to the topic, there's this whole sort of debate about the Bay Area, like, housing crisis and issues like NIMBYism and whether to increase housing. What are your kind of thoughts on that whole debate?
I mean, I definitely am very sympathetic to this idea of just building more and more. Like, you sent a couple links over. The one was called BARF. It's terrible, terrible acronym. I forget what it stands for, Bay Area Reform Housing or something. I don't know.
Bay Area Renters Federation.
Yeah, but they want more buildings. Like, they want to build more. And I'm very sympathetic to that. I think, though, that this NIMBYism, we should think about the NIMBYism. Like, it's very easy to criticize NIMBY, like, not in my backyard mentality, okay? But there's a way in which, like, I think it's clear that, you know, if we just had a lot more, building, a lot higher building, taller buildings in the Mission and whatnot, We could see, like, reduction in housing costs in the Bay Area, through more building. Now, the thing is that, what we're talking about is people who have invested a lot of money in these homes, right? Like, in Palo Alto, there's a lot of argument now about Palo Alto trying to, like, fight any kind of, trying to crack down with their zoning, prevent more building and whatnot. The median home price in Palo Alto is $2.5 million. So when you talk about people, you know, if you talk about a dramatic reduction, like let's say that you were able to cut that in half to 1.25 by doubling the amount of housing. I don't know, something like that. Just imagine something like that. Now you're talking about people who own homes losing, like, a significant portion of their net worth. It's not just like, oh, this is inconvenient for me. You know, like, oh, I would prefer not to have this house next to me. It's more like, oh, I would prefer not to, like, lose half my net worth. And it becomes a little more complicated.
Depends kind of the location. Like you mentioned, like, a city like Emeryville, which has traditionally been a lot of, like, industrial and parking lots. Like, that city would be a good location to maybe build a lot of skyscrapers if they improved, like, the transit there. On the other hand, like, if they were to demolish, like, a historic area, like, say, North Beach, and replace that with skyscrapers, that would be a horrible tragedy. Or to build over, like, wilderness areas with, suburban sprawl. So it's necessary to increase housing, but it's also important to look at each area on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Do you think the Bay Area has done a better job at, like, wilderness and historic preservation than, say, like, Southern California?
You know, I'm not that familiar with Southern California. I mean, I do think, though, that we're very, I think we've done a terrible job of adding, well, I don't, it's hard to say. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, actually. Rabbit, have you been down there? How much have you been out?
I haven't, actually.
I guess, yeah. I can talk. Well, I've had experience at both places.
Okay.
So if you look at, like, suburban Southern California, Orange County is just, like, wall-to-wall track housing with space. And it's still, I mean, Orange County is still a very expensive place. A lot of the Bay Area suburbs, obviously you have places like Marin, which are still feel fairly rural. Even a lot of the, like, East Bay suburbs have, like, green belts around them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, in the East, I live in Oakland myself, and we have this East Bay Regional Park District, which is really wonderful. It's an amazing, it's really sprawling park, like, just contiguous parks for miles and miles. Really great hiking up there. You know, I don't think we need to develop up there. We've done a good job of preventing that from being developed. I mean, I think there's also, like, a realistic aspect to it. It would be very hard to build on those ridges. There's a lot of foundation work to be done, you know. Maybe it's true. Maybe it's true that, like, the trade-off that we've managed to keep more historical and more green space here, and then, you know, that we drive out got to be a way to, like, yeah, just, like, build massive skyscrapers in places that are already developed that don't have historical stuff, like the Mission. The Mission should all be 20-story skyscrapers. There's no reason it shouldn't be. Or Emeryville could be, for that matter, too.
I mean, there's a lot of massive parking lots and a lot of those, I'm sure a lot of the city, even, like, downtown Oakland could accommodate a lot of skyscrapers and, like, the parking lots.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Because you see stuff like, I mean, I mentioned the Mission several times, but, like, the Mission, I think, has, like, a building cap of, like, 4 stories or something stupid like that. You know what I mean? I think they're working on it now, but, yeah, there's some zoning's got to change.
What are your thoughts on, like, a skyscraper being, like, a vertical city where it could be, like, self-contained and people could have, like, their shopping, living,
yeah.
Even, like, schools and, like, gardens? Like, have you seen those proposals?
I know, those are so fun, you know, I do, I see those futurist proposals, you see, like, the skyscrapers covered in greenery and stuff like that,
yeah.
And, you know, and then you go and you look at, like, any, these kind of engineers and then they just laugh at how, like, completely, like, infeasible. so on the one hand, like, yeah, like, I think that we should have, I think it is good to have integrated, retail and housing and stuff. But at the same time, like, what are the odds that I'm going to want to go to the market that happens to open on the ground floor? I will in the sense of, you know, it's nice to have something close, but, I'm a little bit skeptical about that. And it seems like if we just had, another thing is that I talk to, like, people who are into agriculture, and a lot of this push for locally grown stuff is really kind of like a little misguided in the sense that like there's just like the economy of scale of big agriculture is like you couldn't feed everybody if everyone was up, if we just had locally grown stuff. We just don't have the capacity. And so like I think we need to take that into account. Like I'm interested in these ideas of like you do see like these indoor farms that they're developing where they'll turn like a data center into a farm with like super high density. Now that I can see like that's interesting. But.
Yeah, I'm not really a huge fan of these like real vertical kind of cities. Like I don't know what has always appealed to me is the something that's more like that you see in the film Logan's Run. Which was, you know, very influential for me, anyways, and that is more like a kind of like what looks like a giant mall that's also living quarters that has all of this stuff, but it's not necessarily, you know, like a skyscraper or something like that. It's just like I think about that sometimes when I'm in a large mall that, you know, they, theoretically it would have set up to. You know, to have everything you would need to live something almost like a resort. If you had a big enough one on like an island or something, it could be, it would be the kind of place that I would want to live in, but I can't speak for anyone else, but I would prefer that, at least that, lifestyle and aesthetic to, you know, something that's just a skyscraper because mm-hmm. The skyscraper seems to me like it would be very, narrow, whereas something that's more like a giant mall or something could stretch for, like 1 or 2 miles or something. It's not like you'd be as confined.
You like the idea of it's just larger interior spaces.
Yeah, larger interior spaces, almost like a city in where it looks like a city that's like outside, but you're inside almost.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like, almost similar to how certain things are set up in Las Vegas, but just, you know, not
oh, kind
not
of like how
like
the Mirage, like how the Mirage has like that indoor garden or jungle
mm-hmm.
kind of.
Yeah, they have an indoor garden, and also they have like, you look up, it looks like you're looking at sky or something, but you're inside, and you have like the Venetian and whatnot. I think that a place like that. Live in if it was large enough so that you would not get that it wouldn't be like you'd be bored to tears, you know, like confined to like a little Martian habitat or something. You know what I mean? Like, you wouldn't want it to feel like that.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's fine. I know what you mean. Like, those areas are fun. Like, you go through Vegas and there's like a little cobblestone village there and stuff. Yeah.
You mentioned these different science fiction writers like Heinlein and Gibson and Isaac Asimov. What's kind of interesting about these writers is there's their work themselves, but they're also kind of also tied in with the kind of different visions of the future. What are your thoughts on kind of retrofuturism and how different eras saw the future? Like, one example is the sort of a mid-century space age visions from like the 60s versus sort of like the 80s futurist visions, which I guess kind of influenced like cyberpunk.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. There's people talk about Peter Thiel's comment that says, well, we were promised flying cars and we got 140 characters. And the cyberpunk rebuttal to that is we were promised by cyberpunk a dystopian corporate nightmare, and we got exactly that. So Neal Stephenson, so it's definitely true. Like, you look at the golden age science fiction writers, and they were very positive about the future. Man was going to strive confidently among the stars and have wonderful adventures there. And then you look at Gibson, and we're just, you know, hacking each other. We're hacking, like, intelligent porpoises on Earth and stuff. And we have, like, razor blade fingernails and whatnot. So assassins are, like, killing each other's corporate top talent. But I think that, and Neal Stephenson had this whole project, like, Hieroglyph project that he was part of, where he was trying to promote, like, a return to these positive futures and these positive visions. And it's interesting that he's doing that, because I think he feels maybe somewhat remorseful for his role in cyberpunk and with No Crash and whatnot that he wrote earlier. I'm kind of, like, there's a part of me that says, like, because what Stephenson will say is, like, these positive futures that science fiction writers put out there are going to provide narratives for engineers to build their visions on. And I think, you know, Elon Musk gives examples of that, where Elon Musk names the barges that the SpaceX rockets land on out in the water after ships from the culture novels by Ian M. Banks. and it's funny to think of Ian M. Banks, because I don't know if you guys are familiar with his culture novels, but like, it's sort of like he's a very dark writer. He's a very dark writer. And a lot of times, like, the main characters get killed, something like that. But at the same time, it's largely like a successful singularity. Like, you have these super intelligent ships, and they didn't decide just to kill all humans. They decided to, like, you know, partner with humans. And so, I think there's some truth to that idea that science fiction writers can provide narratives for people to coordinate around, and be positive around. That said, like, I'm a little skeptical of when science fiction writers tell us how important science fiction writers are. But, I'm sympathetic to that point of view. Like, the thing is, I went to see Andy Weir, and Andy Weir wrote The Martian. I saw him speak at, like, a science fiction, a reading in San Francisco, the SF and SF group. And I asked Andy about that. I'm like, hey, what do you think about Stevenson's idea that science fiction writers need to be writing these positive futures? So I think that The Martian is an example of that. It's an example of, like, not worrying about, like, how everything can go wrong, but worrying about how, like, we can go and accomplish this, like, getting to Mars. And Weir was, like, very negative on this idea. He's like, no, bullshit. Like, we need to write entertaining, like, art. It has to entertain first and foremost, and we don't have any social responsibility. That was his very adamant view at that time. So, yeah, I don't know how I feel. Like when I'm writing my own science fiction, I actually feel like I want to describe the world as I think it will actually play out, or how it could actually play out, and not like the world. I want to do the is and not the ought there. But I have to think about it more, you know. I think that, because I get what Stevenson's saying.
Well, this kind of goes back to the whole concept you brought up of real politics. politics is kind of driven more by money and power, and there's sort of, as opposed to kind of a people who have these sort of a grand visions about how society should be.
The Soviet Union, yeah. I guess there was a sort of power. There was the power of the people there. So power certainly became concentrated, you know, by sociopaths. The power, I actually think power generally gets concentrated in the hands of sociopaths. And it isn't clear to me that that's necessarily a bad thing either. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Venkatesh Rao's Ribbon Farm, and I think he wrote this. I think it's a surveillance principle. I forget what he called it. Of how corporations are structured. One thing to think about there is, and I don't think we can't get rid of them, because if you look at it this way, like imagine two groups, and one group, and this is just like the tribe, like on the plains or something, and one group has a sociopath as their leader, and the other group doesn't. And they meet and they fight, you know. The group led by the sociopath is going to win. If you look at who is it? Lee, I think, it was Grant. So Grant, when he marched to the South, was a total sociopath. You know what I mean? He like sustained massive casualties. Any sane person would have anyone with a heart would have looked around at all the dead bodies piled all around him and probably quailed. But he just kept drinking and kept killing and kept watching his men dying. And they, you know, it was very influential in conquering the South. And even if you were to say, like, you know, I think there was a book, I forget, Blindsight or something like that, in which, you know, we had some sort of, like, vampire-like sociopaths that we, you know, become part of society. But if you imagine if we got rid of these, and they went to, and they sent one of these vampire things to go and address, like, an alien threat. If you imagine, like, even if we were to eliminate all sociopaths in our culture, and then an alien civilization came along that had those tendencies, we'd be toast. You know what I mean? Like, I actually think that, I'm very fascinated by this idea of sociopaths. Like you couldn't work in a slaughterhouse. A surgeon couldn't operate. Like, there's so many jobs, like, that you couldn't do if you just had, like, you know, sensitive, normal responses to emotion. Like, you know, none of us would have meat if there weren't, like, some mild sociopathy there. So, I don't know. I guess I kind of turned that question on its head. I do think that I don't know if that was the kind of answer you're looking for.
It kind of reminds me of, films like Escape from New York, or Demolition Man, where they the people are also docile. They actually have to recruit some sociopath to go in there and clean house, you know, or do something because nobody else is willing to do it if you've gotten rid of all those kinds of people.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, on the other hand, though, we see it, like these billionaires who are accumulating massive piles of money, you know, most of them are quite sociopathic. A lot of them are probably sociopathic. You know, like, you have your Warren Buffett, you have your Bill Gates, you know, you have people like Elon Musk, who I admire greatly, you know. Even Peter Thiel, you know, people talk a lot of, you know, badly about Peter Thiel, but, you know, he has a lot of, you know, a lot of his projects are to help the world. You know, if we contrast that with the vast majority of billionaires aren't really, you know, devoting a lot of time and resources to helping the world. So, and again, like, from a real policy point of view, like, you know, how do you correct that? Like, how do you take power away from people who have acquired power? It's not trivial.
I think it's important to look at real politics because some conservatives, obviously, they celebrate inequality, but I also think, on the other hand, I think a lot of liberals, they're kind of naive about human nature. They don't want to, like, address a lot of these issues. They just, a lot of them want to live in this kind of, like, egalitarian fantasy world. So I think you got to look at it practically, like, to sort of acknowledge that there are these elements in our society and how to deal with them in a pragmatic matter.
Yeah, yeah. It's not easy. No, there are no obvious solutions. I mean, obviously we're not all the same, right? I mean, we're all different. We have different skills and different abilities.
Do you have, like, a strong interest in different sort of economic ideas as far as economic solutions go to these issues?
I haven't studied it very much. So, I mean, I get a sense that like, in a sense, like, I think, like I've said this before, that socialism is the best thing that ever happened to capitalism. You know what I mean? Like, I actually think that, like, when we look at all of this progress that's happened in the world, the Pinker points out, it's happened in sort of this pull and push between these forces, the individualistic and the communal forces. Like, for instance, I was arguing with a communist, a guy who's, like, pretty, you know, I think he would actually call himself a communist. Amazingly. You know, he's like an old hippie or something on Facebook. And I'm saying, look, you know, look at how much poverty has been reduced in China since the 80s. And you go look at the World Bank numbers, and the poverty in China dramatically went down in the 80s, since the 80s. And now it's like one of the hugest reductions in poverty in the world. And I think Rab was talking about Walmart earlier. It's like Walmart, yeah, it's an ugly thing, but like in some sense, Walmart, like, helped manage the rise of China. Like, this is, maybe it's a transfer of wealth somewhat from Americans buying cheap plastic stuff, but you know, all these Chinese people then who were starving to death got to not starve to death. And that's kind of cool, right? Here I am going to bat for Walmart. But, you know, and I'm talking about this, and this looked like, and when I, to me it looked like a very much a capitalist solution, right? Like, the Chinese had all this communism, and they had this famines under Mao and all of this. That looked like an obvious failure of communism, and then all of a sudden you have, like, capitalism, they loosen up, put in markets, and here's this huge success. And that's what it looked like to me, right? And then my friend Richard Wood comes back and says, yeah, but, you know, the thing is, couldn't have had any of this great capitalistic development in China since the 80s. If you hadn't had things like this barefoot doctor program, and I didn't know anything about it, so I went and looked it up, barefoot doctors, what is it? But so Mao sent out, like, even people like paramedics or something into these rural areas where they had no health care whatsoever. And this program provided some basic health care to people in these rural areas. And I think there is a strong case to be made that, like, if you hadn't done things like that, then people would have been too sick and too, like, incapable of participating properly in a capitalist market, right? And you could say some similar things about the U.S. You know what I mean? Like during the Depression in America, you know, I think some crazy number of Americans were communists. Like 30% of Americans were communists, like in the 30s. I mean, this was a really dark time economically for America. And then FDR comes out with all of these programs, these New Deal programs. And the East Bay Municipal Park District, that was built, you know, by people that the government paid for. All this Tennessee Valley Project stuff. A lot of this New Deal infrastructure, like, they built this huge infrastructure in America. Highways, hospitals, schools, and aqueducts, and reservoirs, and park districts. Like, a massive amount of infrastructure. And then, you know, lo and behold, the 50s come along, we've won the war, and we become an economic superpower. And there's a way in which, you know, you can make the argument that without this kind of communalistic or communist build-out of infrastructure, we wouldn't have been as successful economically. And so, like...
So the key is kind of having a balance of the private sector and the public sector and finding that, like, right balance.
They're going to fight it out, right? I mean, I think they're going to fight it out. They do fight it out. I don't know if you can even specify what the balance is, right? I mean, I think that the hungrier people are, the more they're going to fight. And the fatter they are, the less they're going to fight. that's true in America, too.
I think it's pretty much true, like everything that you said. I think that it's also a kind of a trade-off, because even... you know, in a way, I even admire, like, places like North Korea and Cuba, because even though they don't have, you know, the kind of, like, basic wealth that a lot of Western nations have, it's kind of a trade-off. In most cases, it's an extreme trade-off, but if you look at it, you don't see the same kind of, like, rampant, like, consumerism and, you know, people just buying garbage, like, consuming garbage entertainment, you know, nonstop. It's like if you look around in a way, like they're them being closed off in that way, kind of it kept something for them, even you know.
I don't know,
really
North Korea. Have you seen some of that North Korean like dance and stuff, that group dance? I'm not entirely convinced that that's not garbage media. But I get what you're saying.
Well, it means that like they are able to maintain to be shielded somewhat from something just being like marketed at them 24/7.
Yeah.
You know, because that's how we just live in a world of just nonstop people advertising junk
right.
at you that they want you to buy. And yeah, those places are poor, but at the same time, like, you know, they're not being, you know, they're not like listening to, like Beyonce stuff, and they're not obsessed with all of this, this junk stuff, or this horrible, like, TV programming that we have. And
look,
I'm sure that North Korean TV isn't, you know, isn't anything great, to speak about if they even have TV, but at the
yeah.
same time, it saves something. But you see that also kind of with in Eastern Europe. Like now you see the Eastern European countries that were under communism, they seem a lot more resilient and resistant to the kind of like decadence and stuff that you see in more of Western Europe now, that's just kind of like kind of a mess. So I don't know. There's definitely a trade-off to be had there somewhere.
Like, as a country, like Germany is an example of a country that's not a kind of a balance between like capitalism and socialism.
I mean, yeah, Europe. There's a lot of socialism in Europe. It's funny though, when I listen to Rabbit, and he really sounds like such a postmodernist to me with his critique of this critique of modernism. It's interesting to me that he was drawn at all ever to be a reaction, but I guess there is something like that. There's, you know, rejection of modernism in both. And I'm sympathetic
to
that.
It's kind of like, it's like the horseshoe theory, like the far right and the far left, I kind of meet.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I don't know, what are you going to do? I mean, this consumerism will, you know, this too will pass, I think. I guess. That's how I feel about it. You
know. We are at the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, Scott, is there anything else you'd like to add?
It's a hard one to sum up. I guess what I would say is, we talked a lot about politics, you know, and I think, well, I guess the one thing that I would hope is for people, and I don't think we even got into this so much, but I don't, like, what I hope for us to do as we go forward in our country, especially as polarized as we are, is for us to listen to each other better and to not just, like, demonize the other side. I actually think that everyone thinks they're doing the right thing. You know what I mean? Trump supporters think they're doing the right thing. Hillary supporters, if there are any actual, you know, honest Hillary supporters, think they're doing the right thing. And that we should go into political discussions assuming that, steel man in the other person's position. Like, assume the other person is actually a good person and wants to do the right thing. And I think that if we all adopted that attitude instead of just demonizing and strawmanning the other positions, that we would just have less strife and we would be able to accomplish a lot more.
Scott Jakich, it's been a great show. Check out his blog, Oakland Futurist.
Okay, that was fun. Yeah, it's good. I'd like to talk to you guys more in the future.